everyone would open up to John, the ninth chapter. This is the unexpected Jesus. And for the second consecutive week, you have the unexpected teacher. Which I think is, I can't remember who it was that referred to me as that after the last class. But that's me. Normally it's David. He is still taking pictures out in the desert. He'll be back sometime this week. So this will be the last week that y'all get to have me. The topic for the night is judgment. And there were, honestly, lots of places we could have gone. But I think to really get into the discussion, there's one other big question that we're going to have to answer for ourselves. And so I think to kind of bring it all together, we're going to start in John 9. In John 9, we'll read a few of the verses. I won't take the time to read all of the verses because I think this is a familiar passage. I'll read the conclusion of it after we talk a little bit of the details. And then, if time allows, I might even read into John 10 as well. John the 9th chapter, you have the blind man who's healed. And this wasn't the only time a miracle like this was performed, but this was a time near the end of his time on earth, and this was a miracle that went under a lot of scrutiny. And you have the man who's healed, and he's called before the leaders, the Jewish leaders of the time, and they begin to ask him questions like, who did this? Why did they do that? And how did they do that? And when he didn't really answer it to their satisfaction, they asked him to step out. And then he had a few more minutes, came back, and they asked him basically the same questions. He gives them basically the same answers. And it's pretty interesting there at the end. So we're going to start verse 24, John 9, verse 24. It says, so a second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, give glory to God, we know that this man is a sinner. And then he answered, whether he's a sinner, I don't know. One thing I do know is that I was blind, and now I see. So they said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? And he answered them, I told you already, and you didn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? You do not want to become his disciples too, do you? And they reviled him and said, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this man, we don't know where he's from. And the man answered and said to them, well, here's an amazing thing that you do not know where he's from, and yet he opened up my eyes. We know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he hears him. And since the beginning of time, it has never been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They answered him, you were born entirely in your sins, and you are teaching us. So they put him out. And before we read kind of the climax of it, the point that we get into this, just to understand the full context. So they invite him in the second time, and he tells them, well, he healed me. I know I was blind, and now I know I'm not blind. And then just leaves them to come to their own conclusions. And the interesting part of all this, and which is going to build to ultimately them plotting Jesus' death, is that they could not reconcile their worldview with the facts that were right in front of them. The facts were he was blind, now he's not blind. They're not sure what to do with it. Because of a very important question, which will rest at the heart of what we're going to talk about. Verse 35, Jesus heard that they had put him out, and finding him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? And he answered, who is he, Lord, that I might believe in him? And Jesus said, you have both seen him, and he is the one who's talking to you. And he said, Lord, I believe, and he worshipped him. And Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, so that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, we are not blind too, are we? And Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have had no sin. But since you say we see, your sin remains. So there was one big thing that they couldn't reconcile, that they had to really think about. And that was, is Jesus God? Because if he's God, there's a lot of changing that had to take place. But if he's not God, they'll continue on like they're doing. They can still be in charge, and they can still have business as usual, which is what they wanted. And so because they weren't willing to see that, you have the rest of the series of events. Jesus says in verse 39, you know, for judgment I came into this world. So those who do not see may see, and those who see can become blind. That's the seeing and the not seeing that's taking place. Are people willing to see Jesus as God? And if they are, you know, even if they were blind, they were in a sinful state, they can be healed, they can see again, they can have all the things that humans were put on this earth to have. They can be restored and saved. But if they're not willing to see that, you have, for example, the Pharisees here claim to have all the answers. They had it all figured out. They were the keepers of the law. They were the leader of the Jews, the keepers of the temple. If you wanted to be saved, they were the ones you were supposed to come find. They thought they could see. But it turns out they were the blind ones. And he builds on this in John's narrative as you read through John. This becomes kind of the big point that's made on the cross. In most of John's writings, the deity of Christ is one of the center themes. And so if you were to read through the rest of John and then go to 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, that's one of the big themes in all of those books. And so as we start talking about judgment, keep that in your mind. Let that rest on your heart. That we are either going to be blind because we're unwilling to see Jesus for who he is, or we can be made to see. And it's only through faith in Christ, it's only through that belief and that access that he provides through his crucifixion that we can see. Right? And at least the way John lays it out, that's the only two options. Okay. So let's talk about the word judgment. When we hear judgment, probably a lot of things come up in our minds. Let's all kind of come to an agreement on what we're talking about when we talk about judgment. So, when you hear judgment, what are some things you think of?
Guilt versus innocence.
Okay. Two C's? There we go. It says innocence. Guilty versus innocent. What else?
Right versus wrong.
Right versus wrong.
Sentencing. Justice.
What?
Am I looking at myself first?
Paul.
Convicted.
Okay. Kind of that along those same lines, right?
Yeah. Another word that keeps coming to mind is condemnation. Condemnation, yeah. Okay.
Just the other side of that is victory.
Okay.
Sometimes it's just making the best choice between two things that may not be wrong.
Okay. I'm just going to summarize that as discernment.
Yep.
Did you ever make a balance on the sound, but reward as well?
Okay. And I don't think you meant it as a point, and I'm going to add it because I like the word balancing.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do here. We always tend to go negative on judgment, but as Christians, we better help them put the positive side of it.
Well, and as we talk about judgment, especially even our first few points, we put it in this dichotomy. You got right and wrong. You got guilty, innocent. I'm a big fan of what Randy Tomlinson talks about, that dual tension, you know, where you got these things where, for example, we're supposed to provide for our families, but we're also supposed to give to the poor, right? And so you've got this pull, this tug that you've constantly got a war with, like, how much am I going to keep and provide? You know, how much do I meet their need versus all the poor that exist around me? How can I meet their need as well? And it's that struggle that leads to maturity in Christians. And so I like the word balance when it comes to kind of when we talk about the depth, the complexity that comes with a lot of the words that we use, I think comes with that balance. So as we talk about judgment, we're going to pull and we're going to tug back and forth with some of this. But reward, I think when we hear judgment, you know, sentiments like in the prophets that we've been reading, you know, daily, weekly, the Lord come quickly. You know, we're calling for his judgment because for Christians, for the children of God, it's a good thing. You know, it means the end of suffering. It means that we get our reward. We have our victory. What else?
Reconciliation.
Reconciliation, I think, is a great way to look at all of this as well. That says reconciliation. What else? I need to just take some of y'all know Jim McDonald. He's a lefty, and he would get the first letter right, and he would just go. I need to start doing that. Anything else you want to add?
Remorse.
Remorse? Okay. Kind of thinking about our part of the process.
Righteousness?
Righteousness, what was the other?
No, I was going to say that kind of remorse kind of goes with the conviction and condemnation.
Right. Right. Using that as a way for us to reconcile ourselves with God and move through kind of the, like Paul was saying, the me first way of looking at it. Any other things we want to add to this? We'll continue to add to it. So if you think of something else, you want me to write it up there, you can ask me to, or if I think of it, I'll write it up there. Another question that's going to go along with this, because you know this class is the unexpected Jesus. Obviously, the people at this time weren't expecting him to do this. If you continue to go through the context, you read on into the 10th chapter, he talks about the parable of the Good Shepherd and how the sheep hear his voice. When he calls, they don't follow others. And he builds on this idea of, you know, like a sheepfold and him having ownership over the sheep. Only one person can own people in reality, and that's God. And as he calls his sheep, they answer his voice. He also extends it into, you know, he is the gate. And he opens up, and his sheep find the gate. They enter in. Again, kind of building on this idea of judgment, that he will call his people will answer the call, they're going to be saved. Those outside of it, you know, are left to wolves, are left to the false shepherds. It's kind of the way John builds it, because they pick up on that and they begin to test him, you know, tell us plainly, are you Jesus, you know, the Messiah? Are you the Christ? And he makes it more pointed as well and says, look, I've told you pretty plainly already. I've performed all these miracles. You can accept it or you cannot accept it. And at that point, they were very clear on their intentions to kill him. They picked up stones. They were about to take him outside and stone him. And he calls them out on it. He says, look, I talk plainly with you and I perform miracles and you're going to stone me? And they kind of withdraw for a second about that. No, we weren't, you know, and then he goes more, hiding's not the right word. He goes out into the wilderness to prepare for the culmination of it all that's going to come. They gather up and they're talking, and they make their plans, and then he has the triumphal entry. And the ultimate question of, is he God, gets tested. And it's that test that proves that, yes, he is God, because he was crucified, he remained for 3 days, and then he rose. And it's the resurrection. You know, we go to 1 Corinthians 15, and we can talk about how all of our beliefs, the reason we're here today is because of that resurrection. Without it, nothing else matters. And what that proves is all the other things that he says are real and they're truth. And so as we talk about judgment, the unexpected part of all of this is, you got to live by all those other things that he said, because he is who he says he was. He is. Any thoughts as we kind of are moving through this? Yes.
One of the things I found interesting in this story is that in the first part of chapter 9, Jesus chooses a guy that was blind from birth. I don't think he did that accidentally. He picked that person because it started the conversation about who sinned, him or his parents. So right there we understand the context in which Jesus does this miracle. There's this misunderstanding about what judgment is and how it works. And it's from there that all of this other stuff starts taking place. And I find it interesting that Jesus chose this method to show, you know, what the true meaning from his perspective was about what judgment means and what it is versus what they believed it was in that period of time. And because they were convinced it was his parents or him,
right?
You know. And then the second point is when he got pulled in front of, you know, the court here. My guess is this man, not young anymore, probably wasn't top of the list in his class, being blind, yet he talks in really plain, direct, and truthful words. I mean, he just says, guys, this is just what happened. I'm telling you what happened. You're not listening to what I'm saying.
Right.
I'm telling you plainly what happened. And so you can clearly see the arrogance of the Pharisees here and how they were really in a pickle, because they don't know what to say, because if they admit that, yeah, okay, he did a miracle and you can now see, that was going to lead them down a path of answering questions they didn't want to answer. So this guy obviously had to just be a nutcase, and so, you know, let's just throw him out of the temple and we'll be done with the thing, and we don't have to answer. So there's a whole lot of dishonesty and judgment going on through this whole conversation that is completely misguided. And then when you get to the end of the story, that's where Jesus starts pulling in a lot of the things about judgment as far as the way he and God looks at judgment, and getting them to compare what they think judgment is versus what God's judgment is.
Yeah.
So the way he used this whole situation was really interesting, just watching it unfold and seeing how he walks them through, you know, the understanding of this.
Yeah, and at the end of it all, like you said, when they cast him out, they didn't deal with the issue.
Not at all.
They just said, you were born in your sins, get out of here.
Right.
And moved on.
And Jesus went and found him, which I also thought was kind of interesting. Jesus had heard about what happened, completely irresponsible judgment on their part, and Jesus goes and finds him and talks to him.
Yeah.
I see how the supposedly the blind man who was a sinner, you know, born in sins, he revealed the futility, you know, the futility, the injustice, the you know, like reveal the man versus God, you know, the wisdom of the world and the wisdom of God, and how men try to outsmart God and then they fail at the end.
And it really highlights the blind and the seeing, right? You know, here, you know, like was said, we can assume, because he was blind from birth, that he didn't have the best education, because, you know, other than hearing, there was no really other means of him to access really anything. And a lot of times people with especially severe disabilities like blindness, you took care of them. They were beggars from that point forward, unless their family were well enough that they could just feed someone who couldn't contribute. And he just puts it pretty plainly. He was someone who physically was blind, but at that point, because he knew what had happened, he was able to see the reality. But because those who thought they had it all figured out, they thought we see, they ended up blind to a super obvious situation. I was blind, and now I see. You tell me how that happened. Nope, we're not going to deal with that.
Well, I just find it also when Jesus went to look for him, the Pharisees, it says some Pharisees were there with him. Were they following him? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Were they following the blind man, or were they following Jesus? I don't know. And they, you know, they come up and says, "Hey, what are we blind to?" And he says, "Well, you've seen it. You don't believe it. Your guilt remains." Basically, is what he's saying.
Yeah.
And he socked it to him right there. I mean, he's right between the eyes, metaphorically speaking.
And we know of some Pharisees, at least, that privately believed in Christ. Uh-huh. And who knows? Maybe some of those were some of them. You know, or you know, maybe they were following because they wanted to figure out, you know, what's the end of all of this? You know, what's the ending here? But yeah, Jesus made it really plain to them too.
Yeah.
Like, look, you saw it too.
Yeah. And the thing is, I don't think he really knew, the blind man knew who Jesus really was at the time.
Yeah.
Because he was very famous. I mean, oh, Jesus is coming. Let's go touch his garment. You know, and he's just telling him, oh, some guy named Jesus healed me. Yeah. They knew who he was at that point. The Pharisees did, and they were just trying to.
Yeah.
Get him to admit, he's crazy or whatever.
Right.
And they ended up eating their own words. So
I mean, at this stage, the Jewish leadership had 3 years of Jesus. You know, he had to come at least, they had to come to Jerusalem for sure for the Passover. I'm not as familiar with the other big feasts, but he was a regular visitor, and they knew who he was.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a lot to reconcile.
And the like in verse 29 where it says, we know God spoke to Moses, but we don't know where this man came from. Well, like you just said, they've seen him for 3 years working miracles. How do they know that God spoke to Moses?
Right.
I mean, they know that from what was written and passed down to them. They never saw it, but they saw all this.
Right. And, you know, John kind of highlights that by the end of the book, you know, John 20, these things are written so that you may believe. You know, there were a lot of other things that people saw, but we're part of that blessed group that haven't seen, believed. They just needed to follow Moses to the conclusion of Moses, right? Kind of along those lines, after this event, if you just go chronologically, you know, Jesus steps out of Jerusalem, and then when he has that triumphal entry, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they had prepared some questions for him. Let's turn to Matthew. We're going to be talking 23, 24. We're going to read 25, parts of 25. But this is, you know, kind of the next confrontation where they have to wrestle with this idea. You know, is Jesus God? And so, you know, they ask him a series of questions, and you know, the Pharisees come up with this plan about taxes. You know, do we have to pay our taxes? And he deals with that pretty easily. Hey, give me a coin. Who's on the coin? Caesar. Then give unto Caesar what Caesar's, give unto God what's God's. So the Pharisees kind of take a step back. Sadducees step up. They don't believe in the resurrection. And so their challenge is, well, hey, here's this guy. He's gotten married 7 times. He marries the oldest daughter. She dies without bearing any kids. So he marries the next one according to the law. On down. No one gives him any kids. If there's a heaven, you know, and they're like nudging each other, like, ha ha ha, there's no heaven. Whose husband is she going to be, or he going to be? I've already confused myself with their scenario. Basically, who's married when they get to heaven? And he kind of points out, well, y'all have misunderstood spiritual things. That in heaven, there's neither marriage or giving in marriage. That when you're in heaven, you know, you're in a state where that no longer applies. And then the Pharisees kind of step back in and they challenge him one more time. He handles that. And then you get into like the 23rd and 24th, where he gets into all the woes. Where he makes it really clear at this point where he and the Pharisees stand with each other. you know, unexpected Jesus, those 23 woes, there's no mistaking his summation of the Pharisees. You know, he says things like, you travel around the world twice just to find one proselyte, you know, one converter into Judaism, and then you make him twice the center of hell that he used to be. You know, if that wasn't clear enough, he says, you know, you're a whitewashed tomb. You know, you look really nice on the outside, but on the inside is dead man's bones. And, you know, six other things that he makes really abundantly clear what he believes the state and their condition. And then the 25th, where I'm going to take a second, we're going to read, he gets into this idea of judgment. And we won't get into a whole discussion of which judgment and things like that. Just understand, with a lot of the things that Jesus did, there was layers to it. And you can look immediate, you can look extended, and then you can look like spiritual, or like ultimate fulfillment of these things. So here in the 25th chapter, whether he's talking about the judgment of these individuals, Jerusalem, or all of us, I think the principles he lays down are going to apply to any of those layers that you look at. Matthew 25, verse 31. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on a glorious throne, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another, as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep on his right, and the goats on his left. And then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed of the Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, you invited me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. And then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king answered and said, truly I say to you, to the extent you did this to one of these brothers of mine, even to the least of them, you did it to me. And then he will say to those on the left, depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire with those who have been prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in, naked, nor did you clothe me, sick, and in prison, and you did not visit me. And they said to themselves as an answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you? And he answered them, saying, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not do this to the least of these, you did not do it to me. These will go away in eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. And to me, it just, there's once again this big contrast. You have his opposers. You have the Pharisees and Sadducees. They came up with all these technical things. We're going to trip him up on this jot or tittle of the old law, and we're going to really test him. And so the scenarios they came up with were complicated and a lot of different nuances to it, and he handled them so easy. And then his challenge to them was, did you feed the hungry? Did you give drink to those who were thirsty? Did you clothe people who needed it? Did you visit people when they were sick? If they were in prison, did you go see them? And that's just daily living. You know, did you love your neighbor as yourself? Well, one of the things I didn't mention, when they were asking him that second time the Pharisees came up, they said, what is the greatest commandment? And he said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, body, soul. And second, love your neighbor as yourself. And especially the narrative that John builds out from all of these conflicts, that love your neighbor, like we talked about last week, the foot washing side of it, that becomes kind of the hallmark. By this, John 13:35, they will know that you are my disciples, that you love one another. So, at least for me, someone who grew up going to church, you know, baptized when I was about 15, you know, preached for a little bit, Bible class teacher, for me, the unexpected part of all of this is that he didn't come up with some super sophisticated theological construct, you know, that if you could keep it, that was the way the gate was going to be narrow. It was more, did you do the things I asked you to do? Did you take care of each other? That's what makes the way straight and narrow. Because if I wanted to make everybody uncomfortable, I could say, hey, how many of us have fed someone who was hungry that we weren't related to? That made me uncomfortable. You know, have you ever passed somebody who was thirsty and not helped them get a drink? You know, the clothing thing we don't see as much. We're all clothed here in America for the most part. But then, how many people do we know who's sick? Have we visited anyone who's sick? I don't know many people who are in prison, but going to visit them, it was a different, little bit situation for incarceration back then, but that's the unexpected takeaway for me when I look at the judgment. You've got to deal with that. Is he God? And then the next big thing is, am I loving my neighbor as myself? And that's the hard thing for me to walk away from. What are some thoughts?
I know that Randy Tomlinson always teaches about the two eyes, the problem that the Israelites have with the injustice and unrighteousness, and how this is related, because that's where judgment comes when we don't do what is right. When we are unjust, unfair with the others. Mm-hmm. So the unholiness and also our relationship with the others.
Yeah. So. Yes, ma'am.
I think it's interesting when we talk about, you know, feeding the poor or the sick, and when, you know, we do it for other people, and then when I'm preparing a meal for another family, my husband's like, well, where's ours? You know? And it's like, you know, you do that, but you don't think about your immediate family. You're going, you're doing for others, but then you don't think, oh, well, I guess I should take care of those closest to me first.
Yeah.
You know, and just, they're also the ones we need to love and need to feed, need to take care of.
And they're easy to overlook.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my kids did not nap like they were supposed to this afternoon. And of course, tired kids are also hungry kids, mysteriously, right? Can I have another snack? You know, I don't know that. So here they are. They're asking me for all this stuff. I know they're not hungry, but they're hungry, right? We worked it out, thankfully. They're not going hungry. All right, despite what Jordan might tell you. But it's easy to do, you know. And you look at that list, you know, my family certainly can fit into it. And I would say the biggest challenge is not, are we going out into the world seeking all the poor we can find, you know, feed every hungry person we can find. Find every single, like, we all need to drive to Huntsville right now and visit all of the people in prison. I don't think that's the challenge of what he's writing. I don't think these people that are hungry and they didn't feed, thirsty and didn't get a drink, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think these were people that were just necessarily bystanders. It was a small world back then. Even the hungry and the homeless people, you knew who they were. You know, this guy who was blind from birth, they weren't there when he was born, but they all knew, hey, this is the guy who was blind from birth. We pass him all the time when we go to the temple. You know, they knew the hungry person that they didn't feed. And so the challenge for Jeremy Ferguson is, am I taking care of the people that I know? And that's a challenging question. That becomes that tension that pulls me back and forth.
It's also interesting that he focuses on us, because the times where I've been in a position to help someone who, I just recall one of the last times,
met this woman on the street, and she didn't have anything, just pushing, and I got into a conversation with her, and started talking with her. And I asked her, I said, well, how do you eat today? She said, no. And I said, well, where are you planning to sleep? She goes, I don't know. I said, well, okay. I said, if I help you to do this, I said, I can help you for a day, for a night, but I said, where do you go to church at? What are you doing to serve God? Well, I used to go to church, but I don't go to church anymore. Well, here's my telephone number, and here's my, if you want to go to church, if you want to learn what God wants you to, did I ever receive a call from that person? Absolutely not. But God doesn't focus on that end of this, right? He focuses on the other end, which is, are you doing that? Are you making the attempt to help people who are in need? It's not so much the fact whether they accept the help or they don't accept the help or they recognize where it's coming from. It's the fact that you do what you're supposed to do and let me handle what I need to do with that other person. And sometimes I think we get that mixed up in our heads. I know I do. It's like, well, the last person I talked to blew me off. Why should I help this person? Well, because this person's a different person.
Yeah. And, I mean, we love a good system. We love a good nonprofit. Boy, it feels good to write that check, to sign, I will give so much of my paycheck. It'll go to this organization. It's going to feed people. Man, just a dollar a day just paid for this person to get their PhD. And just joking. The design in Scripture, and you can look at the pattern from the Old Testament, Genesis, all the way through Revelation, is those who have, give to those who are in need. And it's not something that is handed off to another group. Okay? There's a lot of talk about, this group believes in institutions and this group doesn't and things like that. The problem is, if you move to that third point, you're not making it personal anymore. So like if I have a problem with somebody, it would be really easy just to call somebody else up to go deal with that problem, but that removed the relationship, that removed the power in the conversation. If we went through Matthew 18 and we talked about how to deal with conflict, you have a problem with someone, you go talk to that person, because you're trying to form a relationship. You're going to spend eternity with as many of us as possible. You better get used to being around each other. Get comfortable with the uncomfortable. God's going to take care of all that when we get there. It'll never be perfect. It's always going to be uncomfortable to deal with problems. And creating that, and we use the idea of a third point a lot when, like for example, in work situations. If the person a few cubicles down is bothering you, you don't go deal with that. You tell your manager, and then the manager goes and deals with it. That way you don't have to have a conflict. And we can rely on hierarchy and policy and law and rule books and things that'll handle all of that. And then we all just live passive aggressively and really uncomfortable all the time, right? I work in public education. It's really uncomfortable. If I have a problem with a colleague, I should go through my principal to go deal with that person I sit beside. The next classroom over. If my partner teacher and I are, struggling with how to hand the kids off and how I manage the situation at recess, but then I find out they didn't handle it the same way at second recess, now I've got to go include my team leader in it. We're going to... The design is those who have, give to those in need. If your person you're dealing with has got a problem, you go deal with that. And then by working it out, you're forging a stronger relationship. You're increasing the bond, which is a powerful thing for Christians, and it's what draws the distinction with the world. I'm telling you, if you go do these things, the people who are looking for God are going to build a bond. And like Randy was mentioning, the lady, those who aren't looking for God are going to give you distance because this is uncomfortable. And even doing it on a small scale, I was in the teacher's lounge one day and someone said, man, I'm hungry, I forgot my lunch. I used to keep a pretty big stash of Hot Pockets in the freezer. I put a Hot Pocket and I said, here, have a Hot Pocket. I've seen them eat similar things. And they were like, no, it's okay, I'm good. you know, reach for their pockets, you know, let me pay you something, because that idea that I met a need for them that they weren't going to meet on their own, you got to wrestle with that. And if you're not someone who has knows they were blind, knows they had a need, and that was met by God or somebody else, if you haven't already internally dealt with that, it's really uncomfortable. I mean, I experience that from time to time too. Someone asks to help me with something, I'm very quick to make excuses or to say, nah, you know, I got it. Because admitting I had a flaw or admitting I was just dumb and didn't plan ahead, you know, or something like that, that's hard on a personal level. And so when we talk about judgment and doing these things, we've got to understand that these are the people who are blind, that when they get their needs met, you know, they become those who see. But if you think you're over here, you don't ever get your needs met. That's why they're blind.
And if we refuse, like when people, like when you're like, no, I got this. Like when we've all done that. But when we refuse that, we have then prevented someone else from being the one who's providing the need. Like we've prevented that person from doing that. And that's super hard to be, if you're used to being the one, like you're the guy, Jeremy, who's used to giving away your hot pocket, right? So when it's time for you to take something, you're like, oh no, like I got it. Like I'll just be hungry, whatever, it's not a big deal. But then using the example since you put yourself out there, but like, then you've prevented someone else from fulfilling this exact role that we've been studying all night long, right? But it's hard, but like you have to just learn to, we all have to learn to accept that. And it's really hard to admit that you're the one to be the receiver, to be the one being that way. It's really hard, but you have to, and I've had this, something I really have had to work on a lot, is reminding myself of that when I do that, when I refuse that help, I am preventing someone else from doing what God has told them to do.
Yeah. And I see, like, those are the basic needs. You know?
Yeah.
Basic needs, and sometimes we just think it all around money, and it's not around money, it's about time to visit the sick, you know, the sick or the ones in prison.
And, you know, being in prison there, just think of it more like the powerless. Like I said, I don't personally know anyone who's currently incarcerated, okay? So it's not that I can just put a check on that and be like, bingo, I'm 20% there. Think of it more like powerless. Like there are multiple places in Old Testament and New Testament that mention the widows and the orphans, that they're a group that they just didn't have anything. And so they knew they had a big need, and you need to visit them. You know, James says that is pure and undefiled religion, to visit the widows and orphans in their need. And so we may not know someone who is in Huntsville. I keep picking on them because I don't like Huntsville. Just kidding. Think about people who are powerless. Like we talk about in the bulletin a lot, we have the group we call the shut-ins, right? They're there, we see their names. Have we visited them? You know, whenever I was making the list in preparation for the class, you know, I was kind of on autopilot, and I was thinking, hungry, feed, thirsty, drink, naked, clothe, sick. I started to write heal. I was like, that didn't sound right. And I looked, and it said visit. And I was like, oh, you know, that was way easier to do. The expectations are much lower on me. But still, I'm thinking in my mind, you know, the need there is for me to heal them. That's not the need. The need is just so they know they're not isolated and they're not alone. That's the power that God's looking for us to have with them. You know, the prisoned, you know, even when we imagine things back then, like it's always interesting to me, you know, the level of freedom Paul had in prison, right? And I think prison, I think, you know, gulag, and they're locked in, and they're in shackles, and they can't do anything. But they even had, like, house arrest and things like that. They had a guard that followed them. When we think prison, think about those who cannot meet their own needs. And we just got to visit them. If we find out they have these other ones, sure, we can meet those needs too. But for the most part, we need to connect with them. And if we're not careful, again, we create that third point. We want to farm that out to an organization, a third party, a group, because then it's much less uncomfortable. Like, I'll probably make all of us feel uncomfortable. Think about our worship, how easy it is to stream it, okay? Think about the people who are powerless. They're sick. They're shut in. How often do we visit so they can worship, that they can connect, they can meet that need of having like collective worship as a body? Because it's easy to say, they've got a tablet, they can stream it. That's not the same. It's as good as maybe they can get. And I understand that. But we can also go visit. Just some thoughts.
I just also want to add to that. When you engage in people at what you just described, there are going to be requests.
Right.
So the minute you walk into this, don't think you're just going to show up one day and say, hi, how you doing? Man, it's good to see you, and be able to walk out the door and feel really good about yourself. You may get asked 15 things to get done before you leave. You might be asked for other kinds of help. You might be asked for a lot of other things. So you just need to understand, when you walk into a person who is in one of these kinds of situations, it's not just that nobody came to see them. It's that plus all the other things that are going on in their life. They have a doctor's appointment tomorrow. Can you take me? I don't have any food in the house for the next, you know, after Wednesday. I mean, can you go to the grocery store for me? I mean, the asks are endless. So when you step into that role, just understand. It's not just going and seeing them and saying, hey, how are you doing today?
With a cabinet that won't open right.
Exactly.
So you have to get your tools out.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, you go, because most people are not just missing one of those things.
That's right.
In their lives. Like, that, like, you know, the sick or the powerless, like we're talking about, especially like the, you know, we're using powerless because, again, we don't have the prison right here, right? But like those people are going to, like 90% of the time, you have to be ready for one of those other things. Like, it's going to happen. Because right. It's not like they're sitting there alone and everything else is taken care of. Like, that's just not how it is.
Well, and they may have even accepted the plight, but they may not check all of these all the time. Like Randy was saying, you walk into the situation, I'm not saying go visit every shut-in that we have or every sick person that you know. I'm saying start connecting yourself, and when someone's sick, go see them. Or if you haven't ever visited any of the shut-in, pick one who lives closest to you. It makes things a lot more convenient, and when you walk in, you're going to see need. I don't know of any shut-in that I've walked in and felt comfortable, especially not the first time, but the second or the third. Like, it takes time, because you're building that relationship and that bond.
This reminds me of the Good Samaritan, and how, you know, he went above and beyond, had the attitude. But I think it's amazing to do it when we have young kids, and you know, because I see it. Oh, wow, he's sometimes in some little, you know, I'm seeing, we're visiting, we're doing, we're seeking.
Yeah. I don't know if I mentioned this pattern in this class or not. A challenge that I'll give, besides doing all these things, is think about how Christ developed his social network. You know, he had his 3, he had his 12, he had like 120, and then he had the masses. Okay? So he really, really knew the needs of his 3. He really knew the needs of his 12. He was aware and familiar with the needs of the 120, and then he dealt with need when he met whoever else in the masses. You know, this blind man, this is the only story that I know of that we are aware of him, and then he went on his way. But Peter and John, James, he dealt with them every single day, and they had a lot of needs, and they were bound to be frustrating. You know, they all forsook him at the end. But he connected with them. He built a relationship with them that after the crucifixion and after the resurrection, they dedicated their lives to him from that point on. And that's the challenge for each of us. You know, who's your 3? Who's your 12? Who's your 120? Even if you were to write it down on a piece of paper, I think it's a good exercise just to start thinking that way. And then, are they hungry, thirsty, naked, sick, in prison? I won't say confidently. If I were to fill out my 120, for example, it would be hard to do because I don't know if I'm personally connected with 120 people, which I'm saying in a room of, that are all members of a group over 120, right? Mm-hmm. I'm putting myself on the spot. But how well do I know everybody? So hopefully everyone can make those connections. I appreciate y'all's time.